Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to Drunk Movie Rants, a podcast where we talk about movies. My name is Alonzo O'Leary, also known as Lons, and I will be your host for the duration of this podcast. Every episode, we will feature a new guest speaker where we talk about different film topics and movie genres and things that we like or don't like about the world of cinema. Today's episode features a conversation between myself and a new guest speaker on the podcast, my good friend Maria Smith. Maria is a fellow cinephile and the sibling of one of our podcast regulars, Evan Smith, who we heard from in episode 1 on the auteur theory. Throughout the episode, we discuss the indie and art house genres of film as we elaborate on our shared love for foreign and independent cinema and the filmmakers that led us down the various paths outside of mainstream film. If you like what you hear in this episode, feel free to check out our website, where we list all of the different topics and films and directors that we discuss in each episode. Thanks, and enjoy. All right. Hello, Maria. How are you today?
Hey, good. I'm good.
Okay, yeah, so the topic of today's episode, we're starting to head into the deeper end of film stuff. And I wanted to find somebody who I knew would be a good primer for like listeners that may not necessarily be into the genre, you know, because like with the first episode, we, you know, like did a really big general intro, kind of very informative. And then the following episodes were more kind of just like general genre discussions. But like we're heading into a different territory here where like this is an aspect of film that a lot of people can't get into or they don't know an entry point for it. And I'm like, Maria's perfect because when you're dealing with art house films and indie films and foreign films, which is like the big broad topic, like everybody just chalks that under art house now. But I'm like, there's a lot more going on in there than just like, oh yeah, these are all art house films, you know? And usually you don't learn about those movies unless A, you're like super hipster and bohemian, or B, like you went to film school. But you're like one of those rare birds where like, you're a pretty normal person.
Like, I have no like film background.
You have no film background, but you're not like one of those hardcore elitist mean people that I used to see in Los Angeles all the time. Yeah. Like, I only watch Lars von Trier films. Like, dude, come on.
Like, seriously? I have mood like that, but that's definitely not, that's not my whole life.
Yeah, no, but there are people that are like that. And I'm like, no, she'd be like a perfect primer. Because like, just in terms of that general discussion of that genre and everything, you know?
Definitely.
Okay, so where did it start for you in terms of like you first dipping your foot into that pool of like more avant-garde, less mainstream, less commercial type films?
I always think about this. I think like I would want to say it's typical, but honestly, like Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
Because I remember seeing Pulp Fiction like on TV when I was like in high school, and I was like, oh, you can do that? Like,
yeah.
I remember like just like him redoing the scenes like in the diner from different people's perspective and like just the music. And I feel like that's such a typical answer, but like for like intro to films, I feel like Pulp Fiction was like that for me.
I got you.
Which is fine. I'm not embarrassed by it.
No, that's a solid starting point.
Great. It's a solid movie. And like, but I definitely think that's when I first saw movies and was like, oh, okay, they can be different than like, you know, some line of plot or whatever.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, Tarantino's an easy, he's always been an easy entry point for people.
Yeah.
They're trying to get into the hard stuff, if you know what
I mean. Exactly. And if you listen to him, like he talks about all this stuff, and I feel like you listen to one interview with him and you want to watch like 70 movies.
Yeah, so that's typically how it goes. Yeah.
But like the first actual movie?
Just how it kind of led you down that path. So we have Pulp Fiction. What's another one?
So I would say the next one that like deep dived me into it was either Eraserhead or Through the Glass Darkly. I remember watching Through the Glass Darkly with my brother, Evan, on the other episode. And like, he came home from film school and he's like, yo, like try this out. And I was like, what? Like, I remember him, like he literally fell asleep and I was like glued to the TV screen. I was like, this is crazy. And I honestly have only seen that movie like maybe once or twice because I just have like such a good memory of it that I don't want to like reiterate that memory or like do it differently. But Through a Glass Darkly blew my mind.
Yeah,
like,
mine
literally
too.
Blew my damn mind.
Yes.
And Eraserhead too, and just like the weirdness and like the more bizarre kind of like horror end of it. I think those two, I could say, like deep, like literally took me on like the roller coaster of film for
Oh,
sure.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Okay, I could see that. Through a Glass Darkly was definitely a big primer for me too, because it was sophomore year, and we were heading into the experimental phase of film history, and like Bergman was one of those guys everybody talked about, but like I didn't really know who he was and I didn't really care. I was like, oh, he's just some Swedish guy.
Yeah,
you know. And so we did The Seventh Seal and we did Persona, and I remember seeing both of those. I was like, this dude is next fucking level. And then
not his own level. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I heard that he had done like a trilogy of films, and I was so intrigued that I rented the whole trilogy. There were a bunch of filmmakers I was dabbling in at that time, but he was definitely at the front of the line of like, I want to delve deep into this guy's stuff. And I did Through a Glass Darkly. And I remember watching that in my dorm room and being like, whoa, like, and I texted your brother about it too. Like, this is fucking incredible.
That's that Criterion trilogy with like,
yes.
The Silence, Through a Glass Darkly, and Winter Light, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it goes, yeah. Cause it's weird. Cause I always thought that Winter Light should be titled The Silence. Because it just is so much more fitting for that film.
Oh, yeah. I agree. Yeah.
But yeah, you had Through a Glass Darkly is the first one. And then Winter Light is the second one. And then The Silence is the third one. And a lot of people I know are always big on Winter Light. And like your brother is obsessed with that fucking movie.
Yeah.
But Through a Glass Darkly just stuck with me in a different way. Just in terms of what the characters were going through. And like how his style and the very experimental techniques worked for what was going on in the movie because of the main character's own psychological disposition. You know what I mean?
And like his point of like mental health in like the 1960s is honestly insane. I mean, like I'm a psychology major, like that's my background.
Yeah.
And like just seeing that, I was like, wow, this guy like held nothing back. Like,
yeah,
this is a real experience and like a raw look at this, especially from like a woman's perspective. I think that's why he's my favorite director, is like he just really, there's no bullshit with him. He's just like, this is what it is, this is the human experience, like take it or leave it.
It's very raw, but it's also, I mean, I guess I shouldn't be surprised. All right, so hey, like disclaimer for the listeners who are just learning, so we brought him up briefly in the first episode, but the director Ingmar Bergman is this huge Swedish director. He's well renowned across the entire film industry. He's one of the OG auteurs of the 60s. And he's just one of those guys, like, if you know about that genre and those aspects of film, he's one of the first musicians people talk about. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to talk about, you know, more avant-garde music in the 60s, you're probably going to bring up John Lennon. You know, he's kind of like the John Lennon of fucking cinema.
He's definitely in that top five, like solid top five.
Yeah. And like, a lot of his techniques and the things he does kind of set the tone for a lot of filmmakers that are like even working today. You know what I mean?
And I definitely have a lot of examples of that we'll probably talk about later, of like just his close-up shots. I mean, I'm a huge Bergman. I have a Persona tattoo.
Yeah.
And I'm going to flex a little bit because I saw a screening of Persona. They did like a retrospect in Philly 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And the director of like the Ingmar Bergman Foundation in like Stockholm, Sweden, like I met him.
Yeah.
And I showed him my tattoo and he took a picture of it on his personal phone. Oh. And he was like, that is the best representation of like a tattoo of any Bergman.
Oh, that's incredible.
And literally it made my life. And I could have died there and I would have been fine. And I always think of that. So I like, that's like my one cherished Bergman.
Yeah.
Connection, kind of.
I just remember I had been, because film history was definitely a big game changer for me in terms of like sending me down a different path into film and like learning about all the other avenues of what the art can do. And there's an incredible book series called Conversations with Filmmakers. And it's this book series where they just compile every single interview had with like renowned directors and they just put it into a book. And the two that I like, film history taught me the ways of Kurosawa and it taught me the ways of Bergman. And I remember I checked out both of their Conversations with Filmmakers books and I held on to those things for like 2 months. Cause like, there's just so much in there. And these guys, like, they're not lightweights. Like they are heavyweights. Like the things they talk about are like hardcore, you know? And I remember just reading about all of Bergman's thoughts, the way he deals with actors, how he saw filmmaking was like a huge, like, whoa. Like, yeah. Dude, like, I knew that stuff like this could be a thing, but I never knew that it could be so accessible and that, like, it could be such an, I don't know, that it, there was just a whole other world that I didn't know about. And it was just as interesting as all the other stuff I had learned about before. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I have that images book he made, which is like his diary.
Yeah.
And Woody Allen does like an intro to it. And it just basically goes through like every movie and like why he wrote it and what he was going through at a time. And it's very interesting because he's not like a crappy person. Like, he's a really thoughtful,
tender,
genuine, person. And I think it's cool to see such a big filmmaker, so influential, being like very humble and like, yep. I mean, he lived like super long too. Like, he's, yeah. I don't know. He's just like great. I mean, I don't know. I'm a Bergman fan. So he's just like a really great person, I think too.
Yeah. No, it's always beautiful when the artist is just as great as their art is. Like, yeah. Oh, like, we could hang out. That'd be so great.
Yeah. Like, I could be friends with him. And it'd be fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. So we've already gone down the Bergman path. I guess I should have known. No, it's okay. It's fine. What is it about? There we go. We'll go here. So, like, what is it about the more avant-garde and like art house type films that you gravitate towards so much? Because again, you're one of the few people I know that you're very self-educated on this kind of stuff. Like, you kind of found your own way into that. And I think that's really interesting and dope to kind of talk about, you know?
I would say, like, I think like having something stick in your mind and like thinking about it days after, like, really appeals to me. I remember like first seeing like Melancholia by von Trier, and I literally like got physically sick after it. And like literally like threw up after I saw that film. And I think just stuff like that, I've always been like that with like music and books. And I think like just something like that sticks to you and like doesn't leave your stream of consciousness or doesn't leave your mind, I think always just appealed to me as a person because that's how I am. And I think like I love like rom-coms and all that stuff too. Like, I love trash reality, but like seeing something that really like sticks with you and something that really like hits home to you that you like didn't realize other people feel that emotions in such like a beautiful way, I think like is what keeps me wanting to see more films and definitely like feeds my passion, if that makes sense.
No, totally. I think one of the things that's so interesting about more artistic and independent type films is that's just ever since the 70s and then especially in the 90s, that's just always been a much more easier avenue for people to make like more personal and very like intentionally specific type films. You know, like when you're making a giant tentpole film, like you have to cater towards a very large group of people.
Yes.
You know, so it's going to be hard to really hone in on something that you want to say, whereas like a lot more artistic films, like, so like the first film that I know was my, like my first step into the art house, I guess you could say, world was A Single Man by Tom Ford. Evan and I actually saw that together in Philly. And like, that was a big, it was my junior year of high school. And I just made this point. I was like, I know that I need to expand my horizons more, 'cause I've been so obsessed with like Michael Bay films and Kung Fu movies and, and Guy Ritchie, you know, crime caper movies, that I was like, if I want to go to film school and like be a good filmmaker, like I know I need to be open to like everything that the fucking art has to offer, you know? Yes. And I remember seeing A Single Man, and it's like, it's so ahead of its time, because it's like,
oh, it's so great.
Homosexual protagonist. It's based in the 60s during like communist paranoia. And it's just such a, you can tell it's such a personal film, not just because Tom Ford is a homosexual male, you know, but just like, in terms of what the film has to say and the filmmaking techniques, like it was just like such a, I watched it and I was like, this is fucking incredible. You
know? It's so tender too, like the relationship in it. And it's very like, I love that film. I think it's just so genuine. And like, I haven't seen anything like that. Tom Ford is great. I wish he pumped out more stuff.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, I just remember that was the first time where I was like, okay, this is a very individualistic personal story that I am witnessing right now. And again, like once I started getting more into the work of like Bergman, Lars von Trier too, and then who's the other one that like, there's just so many. It was Bergman, Lars von Trier, and then
wasn't PTA, was it?
Oh yeah, duh. PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson. Yeah. He was definitely a big one. No, it was it was Richard Linklater. Yeah. Oh,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah, because of the before trilogy. Like, I was just like, these are very personal, small but heavy films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they can carry just as much weight as a giant explosion in any summer blockbuster.
Oh yeah. That's why I love Gus Van Sant, because he's the same. I think he's similar to Linklater, as like, it's a small independent film, but it just like blows up and it's like really important and like leaves a bigger mark almost than like, I think his bigger films, like,
yeah,
you know, what's it called? Like a Good Will Hunting or something. Like, I feel like Elephant holds like just as much weight as that does.
Yeah. I mean, you can just pack so much into something that's small if you know how to go about it. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
I remember before Sunrise was good, but I remember Before Sunset hit me hard, like, oh my gosh. Okay, primer for our listeners: the Before trilogy, it's three films starring the same two actors, Ethan Hawke and
Julie Delpy,
and each film takes place over the course of 24 hours, and it's like this exploration of this relationship of these two people who keep running into each other, and each movie is just takes place over one day, 24 hours, and it's basically just two people walking around talking, but like, just it's so and like connecting, and but like, it's so personal, and so it just feels so real that you just,
it hits hard.
Yeah, you don't want to turn it off. You just want to sit there with those characters the whole time.
Yeah,
you know. And Sunrise,
I think they wrote the conversations too, right? From what I read, is that like Ethan Hawke and Jude Delphi kind of just like, that was their own conversation. It wasn't scripted.
Came up with it beforehand, and then Linklater just kind of rolled with it.
Mm-hmm. And then before, what's the last one? Before
Midnight.
Before Midnight is like them married.
Yes.
And like they're kind of like way after all that stuff, which I honestly, people don't really talk about that movie as much. And I remember seeing that in theaters and I really enjoyed it. Cause it's like a real hard hitting look on like someone who loved each other, and then like 10 years, I think they're all 10 years apart or something, and like looking at a relationship and just how that kind of goes away in a way, which sounds sad, but I don't know, it's a really good watch. I think
that's the only one in the trilogy that I have yet to watch. That's the only one I've been meaning to. Yeah And I'm you and I have talked about it on countless occasions, and I'm like, I need to watch it. You're like, yeah, it's really good, you should do it.
I don't know if people liked it that much, but I loved it when I saw it. I thought it was really great. I'm also a sucker for Ethan Hawke. So.
Oh my gosh, me too. I love him. I was just watching Training Day the other day and I'm like, damn, dude, you are still so good.
I'm reading his book. I just love him. Like,
he's also one of those people. I'm like, I feel like you would be a really dope dude in real life. Like, I definitely think like we could hang out, have a couple beers, and
definitely.
Despite like your career and your success, you're still just like kind of that same dude.
Mm-hmm.
That I've seen.
He's like an artist too. Like, I think he does like sculptures and paintings and stuff. He's a very like down to earth, cool guy.
Yeah, totally.
He did an A24 podcast. I forgot the person he was interviewing, but he was like in his car talking, and it was just amazing. I felt like I was hanging out with Ethan Hawke.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. It was cool.
Yeah.
They have some good podcasts too. I feel like lately A24 has like dipped down a little bit.
Yeah.
But their earlier podcasts are definitely worth a listen.
Okay. Next big thing for our listeners. A24 is an independent film studio that has been like really big on pushing art house and more avant-garde films forward. Like, basically, if you're an indie filmmaker who wants to make weird shit, A24 is like the dream to work for.
Yeah. Them. And it's like an aesthetic now for people our age.
Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah. It's you're an A24, bro. I mean, like, we can list off some A24 movies. Like, what? Like, Moonlight was A24.
Come on. Moonlight, Hereditary, Midsommar, Lady Bird.
Lady Bird. Was Lighthouse, like, A24?
Lighthouse is A24. If it's Robert Eggers or Ari Aster, it's going to be A24.
The Witch.
Yeah.
Uncut Gems.
Uncut Gems, yeah. Was first performed A24?
I'm not sure. Did you see that movie Behind the Silver Lake that was A24?
Yeah, I actually have. Is that
with, you like that? I thought it sucked.
with Andrew Garfield?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was really disappointed, honestly, because I'm a huge Riley Keough fan.
Okay.
My buddy Cameron, he's a first AC in New York. He's in the union and he works on a lot of stuff, and he's worked on a couple things with him. And I just get so jealous every time. And I'm like, oh, you got to work with her. She's such a babe. She's such a dream. And she's also an incredible actress. Yeah. And then the director of that directed It Follows. So like,
oh, I loved It Follows.
Yeah. I was pumped when I saw that. I'm like, oh, he's making like this weird sprawling neo-noir thing. Andrew Garfield, Riley Keough, like this is going to be dope. And it's just like this 2.5 hour long, like self-indulgent nothing.
It's, you know, so what I mean, stereotypical LA. And it's just like, I just couldn't, like, I watched it and I just was like, I'm not yeah. into this. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that gets interesting, and your brother and I go fucking toe to toe on this all the time, is like when you get into the auteur theory and like films that are meant to be these like very personal art house type things, like I just feel like there's a line, and like some guys are good at like gauging that line, and other ones are just like, nope, I'm going to make this 2.5 hours long and we're going to have this random sequence and this random sequence. And I'm like, you didn't need half that shit. Like,
I think we were you and I were talking about that, or me and my other like film nerd friend, we're talking about how like The Lighthouse is kind of like that. Like I enjoyed The Lighthouse a lot, but he was like, oh, it's too much. Like, it's just like him and like Roger Eggers just like indulging in his like, hey, I'm cool. Like, look at the cool things I can do with these actors.
Yeah.
And that definitely gets tiring. I think that way with talking about A24 movies is like Killing of a Sacred Deer and like all of Langmos. I can't say his last name.
Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yeah. I can't stand him. I'm sorry if I offend anybody. I've seen all of his movies.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have a valid opinion, I think, on this. And I think he just goes too much. Like, he's trying to be like a Lars von Trier, but he doesn't have like the artistic skills to be a von Trier.
I also just think he doesn't have as much to say.
Like, no, and they're all the same. Like, all his characters, like, the son's messed up and he's going to kill the whole family. And like, it gets tiring to me. Like, they look beautiful. Like, I'm not going to deny that. Like, I'm not going to say like, oh, it's trash. But like, just in my opinion, like, he just gets these big, beautiful actors and kind of his script just sucks. Like, I'm sorry. I don't know. I've had this conversation with so many people and I just like, good. I can't get on the train. Like, The Lobster was like a failure. I did like Dogtooth, his like only movie in Greece.
I haven't seen Dogtooth. Yeah.
It was like his first feature, I think. And it was like filmed in Greece and it was in Greece, which he's from. And I thought that was really good. But then everything else, I feel like his ego just got the best of him, in my opinion. I don't know. Tell me how you feel about that.
I like The Lobster because like it had something to say and it was interesting about how he went approaching that. Like, you know, just in terms of his dissection of relationships and society, like I kind of dug that. Like, did it get a little pretentious and like a little too like, I'm foreign, I'm not going to explain things to you. Like, yeah, but like I can forgive it because I understood what he was trying to say. And like the actors in it were great. Like, I love Rachel Weisz and I love Colin Farrell. Like,
great.
Because I think the only two I've seen of his are The Lobster and The Favorite.
I haven't seen The Favorite. I think that's the only one.
So The Favorite's good, but like, again, it's just one of those things of like, I've seen other filmmakers do what you're trying to do better. You know what I mean? Like, The Lobster was one of those. I'm like, this is such a specific way of telling this story that I'm with it. I don't know of any other director that's done it this way.
It's different. I haven't seen that script.
Yeah. But the Favorite, I was just like, this is cool. And I think it's well done. And like, Emma Stone is killing it. Rachel Weisz is killing it. Like, it's beautifully shot. But at the end of the day, like, I think I'm just going to go watch Barry Lyndon after this instead. Like, because that's what you're making me think of. Like, I'd rather go watch Kubrick like flex his muscles on this topic because I know he's going to send it home. Like, I know. Yeah, this isn't just going to be a cute little line drive to third base. This is going to be an out of the park home run, like crowds on their feet, you know.
Yeah.
And some directors are just better than others at that kind of stuff, you know.
But I think he's just not for me either. Like, I don't like that, like, super pretentious, like, but then people get on me because I'm a huge Lars von Trier fan. And people are like, that's like his thing.
Yeah, but von Trier's just so much better at it, in my opinion.
He's an artist. Like, he's just such a, I mean, he's a shitty person, but he's such like a creative. I don't know. I just love him. I could go on about him forever. I think he's great.
I just think his work is so much more unforgiving that you're either going to take it or leave it.
And that's it.
Yeah. And like, he's one of those, like, I can only do certain films from him because I know that my threshold for his stuff is only to a certain extent, you know, like I love Melancholia. That is an incredible fucking film.
I think that's and the then, easiest intro to Von Trier. That's like the most digestible Von Trier movie he's ever made.
And then the one that I really like is the one with Nicole Kidman. It's so weird. But
Dogville?
Yes, Dogville. Ooh. Yeah, because I always mix up Dogville and Dogtooth. But like, that was one of those movies I saw that and I was like, this is weird.
You can explain that. That's like the thing where I forget the name of it. I'm going to sound like an idiot. But it's like the film that he started where like he could only use the space he's in. So if you watch it, like it's
Dogma 95, the Dogma 95 movement.
Dogma 95. It's only like, it's like a green screen room with like a blue floor and he literally draws like on the floor, like house, wall, like brick. Yeah. And like basically just has the actors like, oh, it's amazing.
It's, like, this,
it's so crazy.
It's just this weird blend of theater and film.
It's like that theory.
would not work in any other way done by any other person. But like, because of what he's trying to do and what he has to say in that, it's like, bro, like.
And also he pulls, even if it's in a bad way, he pulls a lot out of his actors and like gives them the best performance. Like one of my favorite movie by him is Dance in the Dark with Bjork. And
oh
like,
my God, that movie's so sad.
I know. I was talking to someone about it the other day and I was like, oh, I love Dance in the Dark. And I'm like, why?
That shit is heart-wrenching. And she's so innocent and pure in it that you're just, but I mean, that's the point. Like, you're supposed to feel distraught over it.
The ending of that film, not going to give it away, but like, it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah.
But he, like, apparently they had like a fight on set and she, like, Bjork hates Von Trier. Like, you won't ever talk to him again. And I feel like kind of the same thing happened with Nicole Kidman because there's a lot of heavy, heavy stuff in Dogville and like, it's hard. It's hard to watch, but it's definitely a good performance.
Oh, so good. Yeah. Oh my God. All right, you're good, you're back?
Yeah, I'm good.
We're on to our classic drink of the night here over here at Drunk Movie Rants. So Maria, what are you drinking over there in Colorado?
So I am drinking Flying Embers Hard Kombucha. It's pineapple chili.
Oh, snap. Okay.
It's made in, it's vegan, has antioxidants. I think it's made in Colorado. Oh no, California, I messed up. I've been having Colorado ones.
Hell yeah, repping Colorado right. Where in Colorado are you? Let the audience know.
Okay, I don't wanna give my exact location, but I'm like a little bit out of Denver, like 5 miles out of Denver. So hell like yeah. Denver suburbs.
Okay, the Denver suburbs, got it.
What are you drinking?
Just a whiskey ginger. Kept it simple this time around. I was going to do whiskey neat, but I have work later. So I'm like, I can't go into work buzzed. So I'll just have like a nice little mixed drink and start things off light.
Yeah, I work from home. So I'm on my break right now.
Heck yeah. So disclaimer for everyone here. So Maria is a vegan. And also important note, she is from the lovely town of Boston, Massachusetts. Her father, Mark Smith. Mark, if you're listening, we love you. Mark's got the hottest Boston accent I've ever fucking heard in my whole life. Like,
yeah, I don't think it's cool at all, but that's because I guess I'm used to it.
Yeah, and you're from there, but like I watched the movie The Departed, and all I think of is like Mark Smith, Mark Smith. Like, yes.
Yes.
So you know what? This is an interesting little subtopic. What made you go vegan? We've never had this conversation, and I've always known you've been vegan. But you've never told me where that all started.
Okay. So I am, I'll be 27 this year. So I don't think I've eaten meat for like 14 years, I want to say. It's very corny how it happened, but I went vegetarian after seeing a Rise Against concert. Very middle school emo days. They handed out a pamphlet. I guess they're like a vegan band. Don't judge me on my music taste because I was literally in middle school. But I like, they sent out like a PETA kind of like pamphlet, and it was like, oh, like slaughterhouses. And I was like, oh no, like that's not a fun time. Mm-hmm. And so literally just looking at that pamphlet, I was thinking about it before. And then I was like, yeah, I'm not eating meat anymore. And I completely went cold turkey. I think I ate fish for like a week. And then I was like, this is not worth it. So I want to say I was like 13. Mm-hmm. And then I've been a vegan for the past 6 years. And then I saw a documentary on like dairy industry, and I was like, nope, not about that. Very influential over here.
So you went vegetarian, and then was there any specific reason the transition from vegetarian to vegan, or it just made sense?
I think also I think I'm lactose, which every like adult person is lactose technically, but I think I was definitely lactose intolerant, and like milk was starting to mess with me a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I read some stuff about the dairy industry, and I was like, yeah, I don't really need this. And it just kind of stuck, and I haven't eaten dairy in like 6 years, maybe seven.
Yeah.
It's been more than half of my life, so I don't really remember.
I got you.
It's kind of crazy. Recently people have asked me, and I was like, oh, it's been a really long time. Like, I think, yeah, you've known me only as a vegetarian, or like at least
a vegan. Yeah. 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 Cause I didn't become friends with your brother until we didn't meet each other until like eighth grade. And then I didn't even get to know you until like end of high school, going into college.
That's true. I was like in high school, college. So I was already a vegetarian.
By that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
The funny thing that like I've always appreciated. So like my roommate sophomore year of college was a vegan. Mm-hmm. And he taught me so much, because besides like the health benefits, like it's just a really great alternative way of eating. And like, it's something I think about all the time of like, I love meat and I love eggs. But when you learn about the other ways that you can like, cause some vegan food is fucking incredible. Like,
especially now, from when I started to now, it's so great.
Yeah. Like, and yeah, sure, it's processed, but like at the same time, like I'd rather eat these processed proteins than some pork or a pig that could give me ringworm. You know what I mean?
Some people say like, oh, well, you're just eating oils. And I'm like, yeah, but like, you're also eating dead animals, which is not good for you.
Yeah. As well. And the potential bacteria that comes from that. And so like, mm-hmm. like there's a big thing, like for a while, like I stopped eating pork or certain types of pork for a really long time. Like I wouldn't touch sausage links. I'd be very sparing with when I got bratwursts, and like, I would just get the vegan, those types of meat links, and it tastes just as good. And I know I'm not going to potentially get sick from it. You know what I mean?
There's no risk. Yeah.
Yeah. And then almond milk. And like, I've been really grateful to like learning about almond milk and soy milk and coconut milk long before they became cool.
Yeah.
Because that became a big thing too, of like, I really don't need all this whole milk and 2% milk. Like, and like, especially like in my smoothies and my protein shakes, like almond milk and coconut milk all day. And it's just so good.
I feel like I don't know anybody like our age who drinks milk, like just straight up milk. Like, I feel like everybody has like an alternative, like oat milk or almond milk. I feel like even coffee creamers, I know people who aren't vegan are like, oh, I prefer like an almonds coffee creamer or such. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oat milk coffee creamers are incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing I can't kick is chocolate milk. Like in some of my protein shakes and whatever is like, yeah. So like chocolate almond milk will do it for me sometimes, and cashew almond milk can do it. But like, there's just something about the thickness and the richness of like OG chocolate milk that I'm like, I'm never going to be able to quit you. It's like broke back mountain. Like, I don't know how to quit you. You know what I mean? Like,
instead of Heath Ledger, it's chocolate milk.
Yeah.
It's a good comparison.
Yeah.
No, I get that. I was the same way. I was like, oh, I can never stop eating cheese. Like, I love cheese. Like, I'm Italian. Like, cheese is in everything.
Yeah.
But after I cut it out, I'm like, whatever. Like, I don't know. Anybody can do it.
But also, like, the substitutes, like, Daiei cheese is the fucking bomb. Like, that cheese substitute.
Like, Yoko's, like, oh, it's so good. Like, I just made a pizza last night, and, like, I haven't eaten cheese in a really long time, but I was like, this is great.
Wait, what's the brand you cut out when you said the brand of the cheese?
Miyoko's. I think Miyoko's. It's pronounced like cashew. They make like artisan vegan cheeses.
Shit.
And their mozzarella is incredible.
Whoa.
Like, I've tricked some people before, so.
I'll never forget when I got to make you a vegan cheese steak when you came over to my house that one time. I was like, yeah.
That was really good. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still really grateful. Like, I still cook vegan meals every once in a while just because, like, it's a great alternative and I feel just as full. You know what I mean? Like,
definitely. And I think you feel less bloated and, like, definitely better. I mean, you can eat trashy vegan. Like, trust me, like, I have two tubs of, like, vegan Ben and Jerry's in my fridge right now. It's totally fine. Yeah. But yeah, there is a way.
Oh, my God.
To like actors who are in like their third stage of life.
Yeah.
Like another good example is like Steve Carell and Foxcatcher.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Love
Oh, I love that film so much.
So like, good.
Your brother so has good. Your brother's been fatigued from it because there was a phase where I talked about it constantly. And it's still a film that like I would not be the director I am today if I had not seen that film when I did, just because really? It had like it just had so much influence in me in terms of like how it told the story, how it was shot. I love it when a director can take a very well-known actor and take everything you know about them and then just turn it on its head, you know. And
that's like my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, and like Steve Carell is easy, but like I love what he did with Channing Tatum in that movie because he had such a specific career and you knew him for very specific roles. And then you have him in this dark, twisted, brooding thing. And I'm like, yo, Channing got range. Like,
and he's front and center too. And I think he does incredible. Like,
yeah,
it's weird saying that because I feel like people just think of him as this like joke actor.
Yeah.
But I think he was good in Hateful Eight too. He had like a small part in the Tarantino movie, Hateful Eight, and he was great in that.
Yeah.
I kind of want to see more from him from where that goes because, but he has such a look to him. It's hard to cast him.
Yeah. I think a critic I really respect talked about how like roles that he does the best in are roles when like he can channel his own physical prowess. So like they were like Foxcatcher, you know, he's a wrestler. Magic Mike, he's a stripper. Like, and then there was one other one where they brought it up and they were all just like physically based films. And I'm like, oh yeah, like it's not that far off.
I also enjoy Magic Mike. I think Magic Mike, like Steven, I know you like Steven Soderbergh. I think it's a great movie.
I love Magic Mike. I don't recommend it to people.
From a female's perspective, like I think it's a good film. Like
it is.
It's great. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
But another person that's like that too is obviously the Adam Sandler and like Punch Drunk Love. I know you want to talk about this. And Uncut Gems. I watched Uncut Gems in theaters and I was obsessed. Yeah. And I literally just watched it two nights ago. And I was like, oh, this holds up. This is fantastic.
Yeah, it's very good. It's a heart attack. It's literally a moving heart attack.
It's like an anxiety ridden, like you're just like, oh, what's going to happen next? And I think that too, like going into like easy to dive into movies, like I think like those films are like easy because you know Adam. Everybody knows Adam Sandler, and I think like watching a film like Punch Drunk Love or Uncut Gems, like you feel comfortable with the actor, and it's easier to get into like the more art house roles he does.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting when you can see that done with an actor, especially one that has such a presence that he does. Like we were talking about Paul Thomas Anderson the other day. And like, obviously you brought up Punch Drunk Love and The Master. And then I brought up Magnolia because in my opinion, no Tom Cruise performance will ever surpass his performance in Magnolia.
Okay.
Because it's so against type. And like the things that you love about him get like mutated and subverted, like the charisma, the confidence. And it's like, you're a sleazeball. Like you are.
That's his character.
Yeah, like you are a terrible person, but like it's done so interestingly and tactfully that I'm like, I don't care. Like this is, I could watch this all day. Like his,
it's also like weirdly relatable. Like you know somebody like that.
Yeah, and he's like, tame the cock, hold the cock, and it's like that's Tom Cruise. That's Jerry fucking Maguire telling these guys at this seminar to tame their cocks. Like what is going on? This is incredible.
That tracking shot when he's like behind the scenes, like walking. Oh,
yeah.
Kills me every time. It's so good. I rewatched There Will Be Blood two nights ago. And like the tracking shots in that were like oh my God, like just insane. Like literally, and The Master's my favorite. I have a Master poster in my living room. Like The Master's my favorite. And he's just so, Paul Thomas Anderson is just like in a league of his own. Like, I think he's like one of the only genuine directors that's still working that is just like flawless in my opinion.
Yeah. Oh yeah. His career trajectory has been incredible to watch. Like, and I talk to people about it all the time.
The only one I don't agree with.
Which one?
Inherit Vice.
Oh.
But everything else is spot on, I think.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Inherent Vice is definitely one of my least favorites of his. Mm-hmm. I get into arguments with people about it all the time. I'm like, look, it's not for me.
You know? I also haven't seen it since it came out. So, I mean, maybe I need to give it another watch, but.
I've tried. The pacing is still just as tough for me as it was when I first saw it. Like, mm-hmm. It just doesn't do it for me.
Yeah.
Um.
But I feel like Paul Thomas Anderson is a good person to get into like art house movies because he has a lot of stuff on Criterion. And like, I think like everybody has seen There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
And then going into things like Punch Drunk Love or like Mongolia, Phantom Thread, like
Phantom
stuff.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I want to bring up my girl, Kelly Reichardt.
Okay.
I just want to give her a shout out because I love her a lot. And I think she doesn't like her that much, right?
Okay. So I respect her as a filmmaker. So like one of my rating scales when I watch a movie, and I tell people this all the time, I look at movies two ways. Film school taught me a lot. And this is one of the big things that I took with me ever since. Like my film history instructor was like, every serious film person needs to get to a certain point where they can separate what they wanted out of the movie versus what the movie is, you know? And that was like a game changer for me in terms of like, I'm not looking at it as thumbs up or thumbs down or how many stars. It's like, what were the filmmakers trying to do? Do I like what they were trying to do? Or do I understand it? You know? Yeah. And like Kelly Reichardt's one of those filmmakers where like, I'm like, I get what you're doing and I understand it. And like mad props for you to being able to pull off the things that you want to do. But is it the kind of stuff I want to watch? Like not necessarily. So like, well, and it comes to art house and indie films, it's going to happen eventually. You are eventually going to find that film where nothing happens. You know, like every person, if they dip their foot into that pool, you're going to get across eventually where you're going to come to that movie. It's like, there's no fucking plot. Nothing is fucking happening.
I need to cut you off, but like, that's like, Evan always makes fun of me, my brother, for it. Cause I like kitchen sink dramas. Like,
yeah,
I like people walking, like Gus Van Sant, like in his Last Days movie, like kind of, it like is kind of The Last Days of Kurt Cobain. And like, it's literally just Michael Pitt walking up a hill for like 10 minutes. And I love that shit. Like I live for it. And I think that's why I like Kelly Reichardt, because like Wendy and Lucy is just like her homeless in her car with her dog. Like, what is she going to do next? Like, or like Old Joy, it's the same thing. And I think like, I just really,
I gravitate towards that.
Yeah, I love that. Like, I hate when it like cuts to certain scenes. Like, I think that's why, that's definitely like my type of like niche drama. Just like the Darden brothers. Have you seen any of
those? Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Like just like Kid with a Bike and like Rosetta and like all that stuff. Like, I just love watching people live their lives. Yeah. And it might make me like a creep, but I don't know. Like, I just love like just seeing normal people do normal things. And I think it's comforting to me, I guess, maybe.
No, that makes sense. I think for me, like, I don't mind sitting with the characters and being with them as long as I know that I can be in line with where they're at. So like, I rewatched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I didn't like it. It's one of those films, it has grown on me with repeat viewings, because the more you sit with these characters and like you get to be with them, it can be interesting. I think it just depends on how it's handled and like whether or not I can get in line with it.
Okay.
You know,
if it's your thing. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I mean, like Sofia Coppola is like another female director that's like easy to get into. Yeah. I think
she's a super good access point if people are trying to get into more art house movies, like Virgin Suicides, fucking Somewhere.
I haven't seen Somewhere, but yeah.
Oh my gosh, if you like movies about people doing nothing, you have to see Somewhere.
I know.
Oh my gosh, it's just a dad and his daughter for 90 minutes, Maria. You will love it. It's so good.
I know. I love her. I really do. I like her. I mean, I loved like Bling Ring and Lost in Translation, obviously.
Of course. Have you seen On the Rocks yet? Did you watch her new movie?
No, I haven't. I had to steal my brother's HBO password or whatever, Amazon. Apple, nice. Whatever.
It's Apple TV. Yeah, it's Apple TV Plus.
Yeah, but I like her a lot too. I think she's like a really great just like a female like inspiration. Like her stuff is so beautiful. Did you see like Kirsten Dunst did like a pregnancy photo shoot with Sofia Coppola?
No, I didn't see that.
It's in like a Maria Antoinette like style, and it's so it just gets me. Like I love it.
That's so awesome. That is so awesome.
Yeah, she's really cool. She's a cool that makes me go into Jonah Hill because I love Jonah Hill now. Did you see mid-90s?
Of course. I was the one who told you to watch mid-90s. That was my recommendation.
I love Jonah Hill. I love how he's like become a real person. I really enjoy him.
Yeah. Okay. You know, it's funny. One of my favorite film friends, one of my closest film friends, we went to film school together. She lives in Philadelphia. She does a lot of like commercial corporate work right now, but I remember she was one of the first people I thought of when I saw mid-90s, just because the way it was shot and the cinematography and just the way it handles things. I was like, this is really interesting. And I remember I sent it to her or I told her watch it, and she hated it.
Really?
Hated. Yeah. And like, and it's funny because her reasons for hating it were totally warranted, but it was just from such a different perspective. Jackie, if you're out there listening to this, shout out to you. It just threw me off. I was like, I never thought of it that way. But when you explain it to me like that, I'm like, I get it. Like,
really?
Yeah. Like she had a huge issue with, remember the scene at the party what's when he loses his virginity with the girl. And Jackie's perspective on that and how it was like borderline rape and like all this other stuff. I was like, oh my gosh, like I never thought of it that way. But like, especially now with America in 2021 and the current state of things, I'm like, I can totally see that makes sense. Like, it's not even like that, like it's weird interpretations, like from a certain person who has from a certain point of view, like I can see why somebody would take offense to that, you know, or would be frustrated by it. And like, to me, I'm like, I think that was one of my most favorite conversations I've ever had with somebody about a film. Cause like we disagreed and it was fine, but like just being able to talk about that and see such two drastically different perceptions of one scene in a movie was like, whoa.
Like, that movie was rough. I mean, like there was that one scene where he tried to like kill himself and stuff. Yeah. Like there was a lot of stuff in that too, which I think was hard to deal with. But I don't know. I thought it was cool that he took it on like that.
No, it's a ballsy move for your first feature, which I think
100%.
Says a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just interesting. And like, that's one of those things that I think a lot of artistic films, like you said, they stick with you, but they also open up conversation. Like a good film, in my opinion, should lend itself to different interpretations. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and you shouldn't agree with people. Like, I've had so many arguments about, like, Von Trier, and, like, I'm a big Woody Allen fan, like, and stuff like that. And, like, you know, it's just, like, I think it's healthy to have those conversations with people. And I think it's, I don't know, I find it refreshing. Like, you know what I mean? Or, like a Roman Polanski, like, all that stuff. Like, I don't agree with, like, their morals at all. But, like, you can't deny that, like, Woody Allen has pumped out fucking film by films like since like the 1960s and like has hit them. Like, I mean, Hannah and Her Sisters is one of my favorite films of all time. It's like I think Annie Hall is like, even though everybody knows it, like I think it's his example of like a perfect film for Woody Allen. Like, it's flawless in my opinion. And it's comforting to me in a way. Like I always watch that. That and Hannah and Her Sisters and like Manhattan, I think is a good example.
Manhattan, like I if I ever want to like give people like a little dose of art house, I'll just show them the first 10 minutes of Manhattan. You know what I mean? Like it's a perfect palate cleanser of like, look, this is the kind of shit that you should be prepared for, you know? Yeah.
No, definitely. I agree with that. And I even think like he hit it with like Blue Jasmine.
Oh my gosh, the film's incredible.
Yeah, that movie's fucking great. And like, you know, Midnight in Paris.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona is another really good one.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona is in Match Point. I really enjoy it. I'm a sucker for ScarJo in anything.
Yeah, me too.
And that's really great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, regardless of the person, like, I think he's a great filmmaker.
I do think it's important to be able to separate the artist from their work. But that's like why Bergman is so great, because when the artist is in line with their work and they're great people, it's like, oh.
You're like, I can't hate this guy.
Yeah. Like, we can't all be Ingmar Bergman. There's going to be a lot of Woody Allens and Roman Polanskis and Tom Cruises in this world. You know what I mean? Like, all right. So for you, if you had somebody who came up to you was like, hey, I'm like trying to get into more artistic, you know, independent type films. What are five films that you'd give this
into the director or into art house films?
Just into art house films in general.
I would say There Will Be Blood, because I think it's accessible, by Paul Thomas Anderson. I would say I want to throw Cassavetes in there because he's one of my favorites, like all-time favorites. And I feel like A Woman Under the Influence is hard, but I think it's accessible at the same time.
That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah, because I think like it's definitely not one of, like, it follows a script and it's very easy to follow, and just the performance is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So I got There Will Be Blood, A Woman Under the Influence. I would say Hannah and Her Sisters.
Okay.
By Woody Allen, because you got, like, I don't know, I think it's just like a great array of actors, and like it's very heartwarming, but it's also like kind of a rom-com, and it's easy to follow.
Yeah.
I would say Night Moves by Kelly Reichardt, because it's like, it was on Netflix. It's easy to follow. It's like technically like an action movie by her. And it's not like droning, and there's a lot of stuff in it. And I think it will take you into like her kind of world of things.
Yeah.
So I would say that. I'm like debating. I feel like maybe I'll throw an Elephant by Gus Van Sant.
Okay.
That's my solid, because Gus Van Sant's in my top two, three of directors. I think Elephant like shows like a good amount of like boringness, but also an event that everybody knows about, and like definitely has a twist on his style, than more than like My Private Idaho or something. I think it's more digestible than that. That would be my five.
I got you.
What would be yours?
Ridiculous, but it counts. I would put Drive in there with Ryan Gosling.
Okay.
Because that is a super art house movie, but it is also super accessible. And I'm always like, if you can handle something like Drive and like the pacing and the slowness of it, you've already like introduced yourself to most art house films and you didn't even realize it. You know what I mean? Like, it's slow. Not a whole lot happens. The camera sits on the actors. So I'd say Drive would be the first one.
Okay.
I'm going to send people over the deep end, and I'm going to say 8.5 by Federico Fellini.
I just started watching that.
Just because... You want to like it's just one of those movies, like everything about it and how it's filmed, the performances, like it's just, and you're getting art house and foreign films in one, boom, you're good to go. Like
in one of the like heavy hitting directors.
Yeah. Like if you do 8.5 and if you watch 8.5 and you like 8.5, there's not a whole lot of other art house movies that you probably won't be able to get into.
Oh yeah.
I'd agree. Melancholia would be a primer for people. Really great film. It's very heavy and there's a lot of shit going on, but golly, is that a good fucking movie.
Now you want me to get my list. I feel like what you're telling me, so.
No, this is good. This is really good. All right, now I got to go on to my movie list and see if there's anything else. Oh yeah, any one of the before movies, before sunrise, before sunset, before midnight, that counts as four. And then... a filmmaker that I really love that's very much in the art house. I love the films of Wong Kar-wai. Do you know that director?
No.
Oh.
Honestly. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So he's this Chinese director, and he's known for making these like Chinese dramas and love stories. And they're like borderline soap opera, like Asian, you know, kitchen sink drama type stuff. But it's so, all of his stuff is so beautifully shot and like incredibly made that like you just don't care. So I'd say the film In the Mood for Love by director Wong Kar-wai. Like, look, we're doing an art house episode. I'm not going to pull any punches. So
I feel like my list was too generic.
No, it's great. Here, throw two more on if you want to go more hardcore.
Okay, two more on if I want to go hardcore.
Yes.
I would say, what's that Kurosawa movie where he like, he's in the room and they steal his son?
Fucking High and Low?
High and Low. Okay. I would say High and Low by Kurosawa, because I think that's digestible.
Kurosawa? Wait, are we talking about the right director? Akira Kurosawa? Yeah.
Yeah, that's Kurosawa. Yeah.
Yeah, High and Low. Yeah.
I would say High and Low by Kurosawa for like a nice intro to him, and it keeps your interest. It's like a noir film almost.
Yeah.
Okay. I would say Yvonne's Childhood by Andrei Tarnovsky.
Oof. Oh my gosh. Yes. Going off the deep end. I like it.
I think that's his... that follows a line, like it's very easy to watch. Out of all his films, I think that was my intro to Tarkovsky, and I think it definitely like wheezed me into it. So those are my two, like, you know, like encore, like harder hitting films.
Hell yeah. That's a solid palate cleanser for people if they want to try and get into the genre more. And then of course, like I said, we already recommended it in episode 1, but Single Man, Tom Ford, like cannot go wrong.
Also, Nocturnal Animals by Tom Ford.
Yes.
Is incredible as well.
I love that movie. Have you seen Sharp Objects? The show Sharp Objects?
God, don't start me on Sharp Objects. I love Amy Adams.
Yes, yeah. Me too. Because you said Nocturnal Animals. I was like, oh, Sharp Objects.
He's great in The Master.
Yes.
I haven't given enough show. That's my favorite personal Paul Thomas Anderson film is The Master.
Yeah.
He's wonderful in that. Amy Adams has really developed into a fantastic actor. Oh my
gosh, right?
100%. She's great. She's awesome, actually.
So good.
Closing thoughts?
Yeah. So do you have any closing thoughts before we wrap up here?
I don't know. I just hope people learn to take things that they like and dive deeper into things. Like, it's fine being surface level like a film fan, but I think that's happened with me. Pulp Fiction is super accessible and super easy to find, but then just do it, you know what I mean? Just go into that Bergman, go into that Fellini, just take that deep dive into it. And I think I don't know, I think it needs to be appreciated more. I definitely think I don't know, it's just more worth in it and more. It's just expand your mind. It's basically watching moving art in a way. And yeah. I hope people will take this and expand the horizons a little bit.
Yeah. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you today.
Yes, you as well.
Did you have a good time? Did you enjoy it?
I did. It was a nice, pretty drunk. So it's pretty good. Work day's almost over.
Even better.
Yeah, no, it's fun. It's nice to talk about film with someone who appreciates it, because I feel it's kind of one of those things where it's hard to find people who agree with you. So
yeah, and I do think it's really important. This podcast, I tell people all the time, I'm this podcast is not designed for hardcore film nerds.
No,
it's totally meant for people who might want to get into film or want to learn more about it, to kind of find a way in.
Yeah, know? And it's hard. It's definitely there's so much content and it's super overwhelming. And I think it's nice to have a guide into that stuff. Hey, if you like this, you might also like that. And I think that's really nice. For sure.
All right. Well, it has been a pleasure. Thanks again. And yeah, we look forward to having you back on.
All right. Talk to you later.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
All right. Bye.
For those of you who are still here, thanks for listening. Our next episode, titled The West Point Edition, will be dropping in early July and will be the first in a special series as part of the summer film season, featuring a wide variety of speakers and topics as we continue to delve deeper and reach further into the world of cinema. The intro and outro music for this podcast was produced by Eric Godlow. Feel free to leave a comment or hit us up on the messages on our Instagram or our webpage at Drunk Movie Rants. Thanks.